So if I may, Chief of Staff or whomever is representing the Chief of Staff's office, may we get a roll call, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Arascada?
Here.
Vice Chair Del Carlo?
Here.
Regent Cruz Crawford? Regent Goodman? Regent McMichael?
Here.
You do have a quorum.
Wonderful, thank you. Regent Del Carlo, will you please lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Please stand and join me in the pledge.
Where's the flag? We have to have a flag to do the pledge, so we'll do it later. Huh? What's that? Oh, yeah, but you have to have a flag to pledge to. You have to have a flag to pledge to. That's the way I was raised. So we'll, yeah. No, you have to have a flag.
Yeah.
You Chair or Scott, you have to have a flag to pledge to. So we'll wait till main board meeting, okay?
At this time, we're going to do a land acknowledgement. And we take a moment to recognize that here in Nevada, we stand on the land of the Washishu, Washo, the Numu, Northern Paiute, the Nuwi, the Western Shoshone, and the Nuwu, Southern Paiute. We take a moment to recognize and honor their stewardship that continues into today. With this recognition, we state an intention to rightfully include their voice and respect them as the 27 sovereign tribal nations of Nevada. So we're going to move on to public comment. And for those who would like to call, in and offer public comment, please dial 669-444-9171 and enter meeting ID 928-494-5069 and passcode 555-5555. I will ask for public comment first for the meeting sites. Is there any public comment at GBC?
There is no public comment at GBC at this time.
And there is no public comment in the systems office in Reno? Is there any public comment at UNLV?
No.
Thank you, Vice Chair. SCS, is there any public comment on the phone?
Not at this time, Chair.
Excellent. Let's move on to agenda number two, if we may. This is the minutes for possible action. Are there any corrections, comments from the committee?
I move to approve.
Thank you, Vice Chair Del Carlo. Is there a second on the table?
Second.
Wonderful. Thank you, Regent McMichael. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. I too am in. And I am in favor. Motion carries unanimously. We're going to move on to agenda item number three. It's the UNLV organizational unit proposal for a sports innovation institute. And this is for possible action. And it looks like we have Provost Heavey at the mic. Please continue.
Good morning, Chair Arascada, Vice Chair Del Carlo, Regents, Vice Chancellor Archer. Delighted to be here this morning to ask for your approval of the Sports Innovation Institute, and I'm here with the Sports Innovation Institute's Chief Operating Officer, Mr. Jay Vickers. And we're excited to move forward with this institute pending your approval to try to further kind of organize the organic sports activity that's already existing on campus and to further empower that sports innovation activity, create new synergies, and importantly, create a front door for the university, because universities are complex places with distributed activity and often people who want to partner with the institution to do work relevant to things like sports innovation struggle to figure out who they should contact. And so this new institute will make that clear. And Mr. Jay Vickers has already done a lot of work in this space, as is reflected in the proposal, along with his colleagues, who I also want to recognize, Dr. John Mercer and Dr. Nancy Lowe, two of our distinguished faculty members, who are working in the sports area, and the three of them have got a strong running start on this institute and want to ask for formal approval to launch the institute today. And we're happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Wonderful. Thank you, Provost Teevee. Are there any questions from the dais? Hearing none.
I just have a comment, Chair.
Please, go ahead, Chair.
Vice Chair Del Carlo, I just want to say I think this is really a great idea with Las Vegas being on the verge of being the sports capital of the world. They are going to have a AAA baseball team. We know they're going to get an NBA team. It's just a matter of who the owner is going to be. And you've already got NASCAR. F1 was fabulous. And I think it's just a great idea. You guys are capitalizing on something that you should be. So this was good thinking on your part.
Well, thanks for that comment. And I should have put sports capital in my opening remarks. So I appreciate you mentioning that. And that's certainly one of the exciting things that we're trying to capitalize here with this new institute.
And I think it's just great the way the colleges are all coming to town. I think we've got the division. No, wait, there's a big game, I know, Friday night at Allegiant, right?
Pac-12 championship, he
Pac-12.
Said. Pac-12. He's tracking it.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Motion
well
to
stated.
Approve.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Thank you, Regent McMichael. Do I hear a second on the table?
Second.
Thank you, Vice Chair Del Carlo. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? I too am an aye. Motion carries unanimously. Well stated. Well, great guy, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
We're going to move on to item number 4 on the agenda. It's the organizational unit proposal for the Center for Drug Use, Equity, and Policy Research. And coming up to the podium, it looks like it is Provost Jeff Thompson. Provost Thompson, please.
There we go. Thank you. Bring forth for your consideration organizational unit proposal, Center for Drug Use, Equity, and Policy Research. In response to the ongoing public health crisis related to substance abuse in Nevada and across the United States, the University of Nevada, Reno is requesting the approval to create the Center for Drug Use, Equity, and Policy Research located in our School of Public Health. The primary purpose of the Center for Drug Use, Equity, and Policy Research is to provide research and mentorship infrastructure to enable the University of Nevada, Reno faculty and students to conduct cutting-edge multidisciplinary research to reduce morbidity and mortality from the use, regulation, and/or commercialization of drugs with a specific focus on the rural West. And, of course, the secondary goal is to train students in these fields. The center will also provide service to local, state, and national decision makers by communicating the state of substance use science via expert testimony and publication of executive summaries that are easily accessible to policymakers, serving as a venue for clinicians to build out training and care programs for vulnerable groups. This center is based on the work of Drs. Carla Wagner and Dr. Ginny Pearson in the School of Public Health, who have a very active and successful research program in these areas. So most of these research activities are already underway, but the formation of the center will create an infrastructure to support ongoing and novel efforts in multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary research programs. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions from the dais? Hearing none. Excellent.
Motion to approve.
A few years ago, thank you, Regent McMichael. I'm going to just say a quick comment. Actually, I'm going to go ahead and follow up with that. Regent McMichael made a motion to approve. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Vice Chair Del Carlo. As a comment for myself, a few years ago at a reception up at the University of Nevada, I recall one of the proposals, one of the individuals that is on the proposal, Dr. Carla Wagner. I met her about 2 years ago, and I recall her saying that she wanted to someday, that she'd be part of a team to create a research center at the University of Nevada, Reno. And I am When I saw her name on this proposal, I was overjoyed to see that it's all coming to fruition. So with that stated, I heard the motion from Regent McMichael, seconded by Del Carlo. Regent Del Carlo, is all in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? I too am an aye. Well done. Thank you very much, Provost Thompson.
Thank you.
Provost Thompson, stay comfortable. Item number five, our program proposal for BS and industrial engineer. Please continue.
Thank you, Chair Arascata. And I'll be coming forward with the undergraduate and graduate programs in industrial engineering. We are very excited to have the opportunity to launch a new Bachelor of Science in Industrial Engineering degree program, along with master's and PhDs. This will be the first program of its kind in the state of Nevada and provide Nevada's top students the opportunity to pursue their studies in a field that is in high demand in industry. Industrial engineering programs typically work in areas of systems engineering, facilities engineering, planning, operations engineering, work design and ergonomics, and quality engineering, and are a key piece of advanced manufacturing economies. Nevada has seen unprecedented growth of its industrial sector that spans advanced manufacturing, renewable energy, distribution, logistics, aerospace, defense, health technology, computing and data centers, and all key industries that have been identified by the Governor's Office of Economic Development. The industrial engineering program will fill a critical gap in workforce development that has arisen from the diversification of Nevada's economy. Graduates of the industrial engineering program will be positioned to secure high-paying jobs in industries experiencing a growing demand for professionals with a degree in industrial engineering. The university is excited to be at the forefront of this initiative and certainly will be a benefit not only for our students but contribute to the state's economic growth. We have letters of support from the Governor's Office of Economic Development, Economic Development Authority of Western Nevada, Tesla, Panasonic, Lithium America, Hamilton, Aero Electronics, and I will state personally, since I've walked into this job, I have been asked by industries for years now, why don't we have an industrial engineering program or a systems engineering program? Bringing on our new dean, Eric Jones, who is an expert in industrial engineering, was the way that we've been able to make this go forward. So happy to bring this forward for your consideration. I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Provost Thompson. Questions on the dais?
Chair Arascata, I have a
question.
Thank you. I just have more of a comment. I just think this is really needed. I look at engineering kind of like medicine. There's so many different specialized fields. And it is with the diversification of our economy that this is really needed. And you are responding to a high demand workforce need. So I really applaud this program. And it just, I'm really thrilled with the new dean there. I think he brings in a completely different approach to what we've had in the past because he didn't come the traditional tract. So sometimes it's really great to have fresh eyes come in and look at things, and this is the result of that. And I was really happy that I was part of his strategic plan, as there were some other regents there too. But he's really listening to his constituents. So well done.
Thank you, Regent O'Connor.
This is Regent McMichael. I have a question. What are the fees involved in this program for the?
So there is a differential fee in engineering that already exists for all of our engineering programs in College of Engineering. So it will be the same differential fee that is applied in engineering programs.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Are there any additional questions, comments?
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Regent McMichael. Is there a second?
A second, Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Regent Del Carlo. With motion and a second, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? I too am an aye. But I do have one comment, if I could, please, Provost Thompson. I've been part of academic research and student affairs now going on. This is my third year. And I've yet to see this audacious of a proposal by creating, I believe, 81 new courses like the previous, which was on the previous agenda, utilizing the three new hires specific to providing teaching of these subjects. This is well thought of. This is something that, as you mentioned earlier, how many individuals in the community are asking, why isn't this here yet? So I, with strong applause, well done, very well done. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Since we just combined five and six, well, actually, Provost Thompson, why don't you touch upon the master's and the PhD?
Yes, and thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk about a master's and PhDs. Many of the things would be the same, but for master's and PhDs, we'll be having, for master's programs specifically, advanced knowledge in the field associated with management skill sets and leadership training, and a master's degree in industrial engineering, and also at the PhD level for having cutting-edge research for leading in areas of advanced manufacturing, logistics, systems engineering, quality control. So training the next generation of leaders who will be developing this field as we go forward. So looking for not only enhancing the skill sets of students with bachelor's degrees, but also building leaders in the field. And submit that for your consideration. Everything else is essentially the same.
In the proposal, it stated that they're going to be classes are going to be in the engineering building. Is that correct?
Yes, Regent Arascata. With our new engineering building, we have the capacity to teach the classes and have the research labs in our new Pennington engineering building.
What is the time frame for the hiring of the three new instructors?
Approval from the Board of Regents, we will start the hiring process in the spring, and also going through the accreditation process with ABET for accreditation for new engineering programs. So we will initiate that process at the same time.
Throughout Nevada, what are the job opportunities?
Everything from advanced manufacturing in plants such as Tesla, building and designing new manufacturing lines, to quality control, manufacturing in mining, and also in maintenance and equipment maintenance, and on to logistics. Everything from Amazon distribution centers to UPS hires industrial engineers to develop their businesses.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Are there any more comments or questions from the dais?
Regent Del Carlo, I have one question. Thank you.
Please.
Provost Thompson, how long does it take for the accreditation when you start that process? You're laughing. Why?
I'm sorry. I want to be a little hesitant because it does. We need to be accredited before we graduate our first students, and accreditation typically takes 3 to 4 years to go through the process.
So thank you. I didn't realize that was such a long process.
So we will inform them after we have approval and start the process and tell them we intend to go through the process so we can get in the queue to be accredited.
That's as rigorous as a medical school, isn't it?
It is very similar to medical school.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Any more questions, comments from the dais? Hearing none, we're going to... all in favor of agenda item number 6, motion by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Aye, too, am an aye. Motion carries unanimously. Well done.
Thank you very much.
Up next is agenda item number 7, which is Truckee Meadows Community College Program Proposal as an Agriculture Science.
Thank you.
And on the podium, we have Provost Jeffrey Alexander. There we go.
Thank you very much, and good morning, Chair Arascata, Vice Chair Del Carlo of the ARSA Committee, members of the ARSA Committee, Vice Chancellor Archer, assistant presidents, and colleagues. My name is Jeffrey Alexander. I'm the vice president of academic affairs at Truckee Meadows Community College, for the record. And it's my pleasure this morning to stand before you and to bring you this proposal for an Associate of Science degree in agricultural science. The college is very excited to bring this forward. It is a two-year transferable program with two tracks, a general agriculture track and an animal science track. The curriculum includes a core of courses that focus on math and science and economics and will partially satisfy the Bachelor of Science in Agricultural Science at the University of Nevada, Reno. Students who intend to transfer to other institutions can certainly do so, but that is our principal partner, and it is important to note that at UNR, out of the full number of transfer students who come in to study STEM, fully 10% of them are ag science students. And indeed, out of the number of students that TMCC sends to UNR each year, between the years 2011 and 2020, 40% of them were STEM majors. So we're very excited about that. It's a tremendous opportunity. Agriculture is one of the largest employers worldwide. Certainly in Nevada, it is a $1.6 billion industry, over 16,000 jobs. However, importantly, most of those jobs for diverse members of the workforce are at the lowest levels. This is an effort to transform that, and certainly the USDA and other agencies have been very interested in transforming food science and related food agricultural industry jobs and diversifying that workforce because it has not been very diverse for a long time. Agricultural science is the third most common STEM transfer discipline area at UNR, as I mentioned, behind engineering and natural sciences. And per the USDA, the field of agricultural science is working to achieve equitable participation in technical and leadership positions. This AS will identify a clear pathway for diverse students interested in the field. Students will be able to explain concepts and theories related to genetics, cellular processes, molecular structure, evolutionary processes, and so forth, design a controlled experiment, interpret agricultural data, and be proficient in basic lab equipment and follow safe practices. Per the USDA, the majority of diverse members of the ag workforce are at the lowest level, so this will be an effort to transform that and ensure that at the level of food science and in laboratories and offices throughout the state, diverse members of the community are represented well. This pathway has existed as a transfer degree for some time for those who knew how to look for it, but there it was not an articulation agreement unique to ag science. Now, having concluded that articulation agreement with UNR, we are prepared to send AS Ag Science graduates to UNR to continue their studies at the bachelor's level. And I'll happily take your questions.
Thank you, Vice President Alexander. Any questions from the dais? Seeing none, or hearing none, I do want to put in a couple of kudos to you all. I want to express my appreciation for the well-described methodology used in determining the projected FTE figures, which is on page 13. Additionally, beginning on page 14 and transitioning over to page 15, with the student services and academic advising, although the projected start date is for the program is not till fall of 24, I want to hear a little bit more about the academic advisors, that they're going to be well prepared to assist the students to embark in this unique program.
Yes, happily. Thank you, Chair Escada. Again, Jeffrey Alexander for the record. The advising team that we have at TMCC is very robust, and they're very familiar with STEM disciplines. Importantly, this program involves the creation of a handful of new courses in AGSC Agricultural Science and the offering of a course in Applied Statistics, but the bulk of the programming is already in biology and will be offered by full-time existing biology faculty. And for that reason, the team in advising is very well prepared to speak to those kinds of transfer degrees and to advise students accordingly, especially as it was possible in the past very often for students to find their way through an AS science program and then make their way to a BS in ag science at UNR, but perhaps not having had the AGSC courses. This will provide a much clearer picture, and the team, therefore, with that articulation agreement in place, is prepared to advise students very accurately, and we can also prepare those materials for students to find. We've also prepared a wide array of career maps that We're very proud to have launched just in the last couple of months, and they illustrate for students very clearly how they can make their way from an associate degree to a bachelor's degree and all the various jobs and careers that extend from each of those levels, as well as from postgraduate study.
Thank you. It's obvious that you've had, that your team has had some thorough discussions with the University of Nevada, Reno's College of Agriculture. Beginning on page 13, there's a description of the matriculation from the associate's degree to the bachelor's program. Those are also extremely well described. What was the beginning of this program? How did it initiate? What was the infrastructure of the entire program?
That's an excellent question, Chair Escada. I will tell you that the college became aware of an opportunity for a grant from the USDA a couple of years ago, about a year and a half ago. We pursued that grant, hoping to have that in time to partner with this program initiative. The grant application was not successful. However, it did really bring a great deal of attention to ag science for us. We began to recognize immediately that we already possessed a wide array of courses that were necessary for an AS in ag science. A few additional courses in AGSC would be required, but the USDA proposal, that call for proposals, asked for those kinds of initiatives that would help to bring more Hispanic and more Native American students to ag science and help them to matriculate to a bachelor's degree in an effort to try to diversify that workforce. This is how we initially expected and found that there would be an opportunity here. This then led to a discussion at the HHMI discussion, which is the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, helped to host a conference about STEM transfer at UNR in September 2022. And it was there we discovered that fully 10% of UNR STEM majors, transfer majors, are in ag science. And that is when we really recognized that, given that we have already 40% of our transfer students in STEM heading to UNR, that we had a real chance here to begin to fill out that pipeline and to give students an associate degree that matched the bachelor's degree that they would be pursuing at UNR.
Wonderful description. Thank you very much. Once again, are there any other questions, comments from the dais?
Chair Arascada, I just want to say,
please,
too, this is the only program in the state, what I read in the briefing paper. So, again, I think it's really great, the fact that you went to this conference, and how valuable conferences are for all of us in this industry. There's so many out there, and it's where you network, and you really do learn from others, that you were able to take that knowledge and apply it to your college. I think that's terrific. And any student that's going to start with TMCC, I mean, we know the value of a community college. Everybody knows that I'm a big champion for the community colleges. You get smaller classes, individual attention from your instructors because they're not doing research necessarily. And, of course, the cost is so much lower. And then to have it, to work with UNR and have it all articulate and transfer, just with our 95.4% transfer rate here in Nevada within our system, I think it just bodes so well. So I would say to you, Dean, are you a dean? I forget your title.
The Vice President of Academic
Vice President,
Affairs,
okay,
yes.
Vice President Alexander, to keep going to conferences. And, I mean, this is responding to the workforce needs. And I think food's important to all of us in this room.
Yes, indeed, Vice Chair Del Carlo. I thought of this myself. This is a large proportion of the economic activity here in this state. Certainly, it is a big piece of the pie, and we can all agree that pie is delicious.
Yeah, thank you for this.
Very well stated. So I'm going to put this out there. Is there a motion on the table for the program proposal of Chuck Meadows Community College for an Associate of Science in Agriculture?
Motion to approve.
I'll second.
Chair McMichael, thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair Del Carlo. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? I too am an aye. Well done, Vice President Alexander. Very well done.
Thank you very much.
We are going to move on to agenda number 8. which is the in-sheet planning report, academic master plan revision. Coming up to the podium is going to be the senior analyst for academic and student affairs, Tarina Caserto. Ms. Caserto, please.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Arascada, Vice Chair Del Carlo, and committee members. For the record, Tarina Caserto, senior analyst, academic student affairs. Item before you, item number 8, is the 2023-27 planning report edition. To provide a little bit of background on this, Title IV, Chapter 14, Section 3 provides for a master plan, and on a biennial basis, each institution presents for consideration to the Academic Research and Student Affairs Committee plans for new degree programs, student services, research activities for the planning period of 4 years. The planning report includes any associate, baccalaureate, master's, or doctoral programs that might come forward in the next few years. So what we see today on the interim years between those biennial years are additions to that planning report. So before you is a list from each institution of programs that may come forward in the next year. So they need to be included in the 2023 planning report as additions. And so I'm here today to request your approval on these additions.
Thank you, Ms. Caserto. Mm-hmm. Are there any questions from the dais? Quiet group early morning in Las Vegas. I too feel that it was an extremely well done, the 2023-2027. The planning report, it was extremely well done. With that stated, is there a motion on the table for approval?
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Regent McMichael. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Vice Chair Del Carlo. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? I too am an aye. Thank you, Ms. Caserto.
Thank you.
So we are going to move on to number 9. Number 9 is the new program report and no program review, and it's going to be presented by the Vice Chancellor of Academic and Student Affairs, Renee Davis, and she'll be presenting on the required by board policy, Title IV, Chapter 14, Section 6. Ms. Davis, please.
Thank you, Chair Arascada. Renee Davis, Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. So this year, we're going to approach things slightly differently as we have in the past. And we used to have the new program review and the existing program review in a single agenda item. This year, we split it out because while they're governed by the same section and board policy, they're somewhat different. So we thought it might be easier to talk about them individually. So I'm just going to start with the new program review. And this is a chance for the board to see outcomes in terms of enrollment and expenses in comparison with the original program proposal. So today you approved several program proposals, and in those proposals you have first, third, and fifth year estimates of what the campus is expecting to see. And so the purpose of this report really is to follow up on those program proposals. And so when you open that, you'll see that it starts out with several tables. And those have both the estimated and the actuals, and again, first, third, and fifth year. And so for the first year, you'll have seen the programs that started in fall of 22, and then, of course, working back from that. So with that, I would entertain any questions about the policy or the report, and then if you have questions about specific programs, I would defer to the campuses.
Thank you, Ms. Davis. Are there any questions from the dais? Hearing none. I do have a few questions, if I could, please. When enrollments are higher than estimated, how are the increased needs for faculty met?
So, Regent Arascada, I would have to defer to the campuses on that. I mean, there are several things that would feed into that. And it is probably very program specific. But definitely questions that I think are important to consider as we look to the future. And one thing I didn't know in my comments was that there is, after the tables, there are also narratives from the campuses. So they do explain usually the causes they think are responsible for the differences and also their plans going forward to improve enrollment.
Thank you. Yeah, I did read all the narratives associated with some of the program proposals, but let me just pepper you with a couple more questions if I could. When enrollments are lower than estimated, and once again, this maybe have to be put over to the campus, what estimates to or what happens to faculty teaching in that program? So what happens to any excessive revenue?
One moment.
One second. Thank you.
Hi, Chris Heavey, Executive Vice President and Provost of UNLV. And so, for example, I can speak to that for some of our programs that had lower than expected enrollment. We started a program in general studies as a degree completion opportunity for people who had accumulated many credits and were looking for a quick path to be able to earn a degree upon returning to the institution. We haven't so far been able to recruit people into that program. We've actually recruited people back to the university, but they've tended to want to finish in the program they started in. So it's served somewhat of a purpose to try to increase degree completions. But as you mentioned, we listed one faculty member there who would be involved in teaching some of those courses. And the reality is that they have many other opportunities to teach courses because the curriculum for these programs, many of them overlap with other existing programs, existing degree programs. So the faculty are still busy teaching courses, and generally the institutions hire many part-time instructors, and when we have excess full-time instructors, we're able to hire fewer part-time instructors. So I want to assure you that teaching resources don't go to waste. All of the faculty are busy engage teaching other students, even when we don't have students enrolling at the levels that we anticipate for those programs. And just to also answer your other general question, I think I can speak for the other provosts of saying that when we estimate those enrollments at 1, 3, and 5 years, they're educated guesses based on the best information that we have. I think often those guesses are pretty good, but they do sometimes miss by meaningful amounts. Due to things like this factor in the general studies program where we're recruiting students back to the university, but they're deciding to pursue their original degrees rather than coming into the degree that would allow them the shortest path to completion. So the educated guesses are sometimes not exactly on the mark, and then we make adjustments with using those resources for other existing demands.
Thank you. But while we have requirements to maintain the R1 campuses, in addition to the other institutes, we don't want to have the faculty burning the candle at both ends. We want to make sure they have opportunity for research publications, and on the other campuses, opportunity to teach a specific number of courses. When those courses become too many courses for that one faculty member, is there going to be or will there be increase in hiring additional faculty to pick up that workload?
Again, Chris Heavey, UNLV Provost for the record. The fudge factor, so to speak, that I think all of the campuses maintain is a significant workforce of part-time instructors who are on semester-by-semester contracts, and those are more adjustable teaching loads, and we use that to both manage when we have higher than expected demand, we can bring in more adjunct faculty into those roles. And when we have lower than expected demand, we have fewer. And so I think I can speak for the other provosts of saying that we manage the teaching loads of our full-time faculty with the goal of, you, as you state, of maintaining stability and predictability. And so full-time faculty teaching loads are generally known well in advance
And then we can make the last minute adjustments by changes to the adjunct teaching staff. Hope that helps explain and answer your question.
Yes, it does. But once again, those contracts have to be in place prior to the semester. And if the projected student, if the FTE is way high, I'm just going to use round numbers of 100 students and only 7 enroll, do you need to hire the part-time faculty? Or would those 7 students be absorbed in another class? I'll let you or Provost Thompson answer one of these questions.
Yeah. Call in to help.
Thank you. Provost Jeff Thompson, University of Nevada, Reno, for the record. Regent Arascata, it is a very complicated process, and it is something we pay specific attention to when we are trying to build new programs, to look at teaching loads, because a lot of times these are faculty who are incredibly engaged and excited about building a new program. And you're exactly right. We don't want to burn them out by giving them excessive work as we bring these on. So we are looking at this constantly. And for your example, if we have projected 100 and we have 7, sometimes they are absorbed into other courses. But we also, as we build these programs, we don't start with all the courses offered immediately. We usually bring this in over time as a student would be going through their degree process and degree program. So we don't need to have all the resources immediately. But also, as Provost Heavey has stated, we're also looking at what other experts do we have in the community who can help us as we build the programs, and having that community engagement is usually part of the design process. It's not usually written on the proposals that we have a number of LOAs who could teach a specialized class for us to help us build the program as we go forward. But it is very complicated, and we are very careful to make sure that we are not, for a long period of time, having faculty overburdened because they have committed to new opportunities for our students. So I hope that answers your question. I don't have a specific answer for your question, but it is a complicated process, and we are very careful as we go through the design and also the implementation of new programs.
Thank you. I'm not going to let Vice President Alexander off the hot seat either. When identifying some of the contributing factors for variance in enrollment or expenses from the original proposal, what are the steps they could or planned to mitigate the challenges?
Thank you, Chair Arascata, Vice Chair Del Carlo. Happy to answer that. When we face challenges regarding enrollment, we sometimes have to be very prudent with the program proposal. We do have a very robust 1, 3, and 5-year program review process, and we do see from time to time that some of these programs are less well enrolled than anticipated. As Provost Thompson mentioned, sometimes this is an educated guess. We do our best for forecasting. We do our very best, especially at TMCC, where we have a fixed a set of resources for a given academic year. We do our best to ensure that we can maximize the existing opportunity, the existing faculty, the existing part-time instructors, and also make best use of the available courses we already propose and already offer. For that reason, we will have, in the case, for example, of an ag science degree, perhaps 9 or 10 of the credits out of a 60-credit degree might be newly created courses. But the remainder are existing courses that we presently offer. So if a program were to be unsuccessful after the 5-year point, and as happened just yesterday at the AAC meeting, we do from time to time deactivate a program that hasn't met the mark. And that's sometimes an unfortunate outcome if the targets and the estimates were not as desired. But in those cases, that's the prudent thing to do. It's best for the institution and for the workforce in many cases to ensure that we're delivering something that's truly needed or that students will truly use and make best use of as they transfer to the university or elsewhere. For us, that would be unfortunate, but sometimes it is the most pragmatic and indeed the right thing to do.
That sounds great. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Following those descriptions, in regards to agenda item number 9, the new program review, this is an information-only item, and we're going to transition into...
Chair Erskine, I have a question first.
Please.
Thank you.
Please, Vice Chair Del Carlo.
Okay, so I think this is great you review, and, you know, we're kind of learning how this all gets started. The seed was... Vice President Alexander at a conference and got a new program going, and that'll be on the report at some point down the road. So my question is, with this, how does the institution, do you advertise these classes to students to let them know? I mean, this has got to be a big part of the advisors, right, that are able to let the students know that these programs are there? I mean, how do we get that enrollment, I guess, out there, and then how do we keep it going and get it increased?
Renee Davis for the record. So I would say it's a combination of things. So the campuses definitely, it could vary program by program, but they definitely market. I think they start with existing students, but they also, you know, have different things. They go to recruitment fairs and those types of things to highlight their programs. You know, should they not be getting those numbers, and they make corrections and try to go back and think of a better way to reach students. So they do use a variety, and ranging from outreach to high school students to adults, you know, potential adult students. I know some campuses recruit companies, you know, so it is pretty broad, but there is recruitment and outreach going on, although it might vary by program.
Okay. The advisors on the campuses, they must have a big piece of this.
Yes, thank you, Renee Davis, for the record. So, yes, that's a huge part of it. And as these new programs go on the books, you know, the advising departments are notified. They're always very, you know, well up to date with the catalog and the programs that are offered. And I know that lots of times the advising department will reach out to the faculty within the programs to come talk to the group of advisors to educate them a little more on the program. So there is really a good communication line, I think, at all of our campus, and it's something that we've worked on a lot, you know, for the last many years.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Del Carlo. Is there any more input from the dais? Wonderful. Let's transition on to agenda item number 10, the existing program review, which is going to be presented by the Senior Analyst for Academic and Student Affairs, Charina Caserto.
Good morning. For the record, Tarina Caserto, Academic Student Affairs Senior Analyst. Today I have to present to you the existing program review. This report meets existing policy in that a review of existing programs shall be conducted by the universities, the state university, and the community colleges on at least a 10-year cycle. This ensures academic quality and helps determine if need, student demand, available resources support the program continuation. Institutions conduct their program reviews as required by this board policy. They publish their reviews, and then they forward the summaries to our office, the chancellor's office, to compile into one report to bring to this committee. So I will talk a little bit about the composition of this report. Aside from the executive summary, there are a couple of tables of the report. The first table is a summary of eliminated and new programs from the last academic year. The second table is a summary of characteristics of all the programs reviewed the last year, which are included in this report. So the summary is the number of students in a declared major,
the graduates in the last few years, the service headcount, and all those numbers are reflected in the last section of this report, which are all the summaries from each program of each institution, each program that was reviewed. So it may be a little heavy reading, but they're actually summaries of the programs, and you can see all the work that goes into these from each institution. I have a love-hate relationship with compiling this report, obviously, because it is so long, but I love doing this because you can see the hard work that the institutions are doing. You can see in their review process what they're looking at. And it is just a beautiful compilation of those reviews that have come in this last year. Additionally, policy provides for, when we present this report to you, policy provides for the Chancellor's Office to select two institutions to come before you to give a presentation of their review process with an example of a review that was done this year. And so we have that for you today. We have two presentations. The first presentation will be from UNRVO's Vice Provost of Undergraduate Education, Dave Shintani, and he will, he can come to the podium, please, and he will do the first presentation. Then we will have a presentation from Great Basin, and then I will come back to close this information item.
Ms. Concerto?
Yes, sir.
If I please, prior to the institutional presentations, going back to your original opening, the summary starting on page 9 of the existing program review, they include a description of the review process and the criteria. I just was curious if there's a consistency between the institutions in this area.
Yes, excellent question. I appreciate the question. So although the process may slightly vary between the campuses, because institutions have different missions and responsibilities, there is consistency between the reviews. There's going to be comparable data, which you'll see on the first page of each review, of each summary, but also established in board policy will be criteria. They'll be reviewing both qualitative and quantitative data to do the review. They'll be taking a look at the need and the demand for the program. They'll be taking a look at the relation to the institution's mission, the cost involved, relationships to other programs in the system, student outcomes, and then perhaps even the quality and adequacy of the resources that are available for the program. So you'll find that consistently throughout the reviews within the institutions and between the institutions.
Thank you. There's a copious amount of information provided in these reviews. If someone in the public or in the audience wants to receive more information or about a specific program review, where would they garner that information?
That's another great question. So at the very end of each of the summaries that are provided in this report, there will be a link to the institutional's full program review. Each one of them has that.
Okay. Well, that was an easy answer. Thank you very much. Let's go on to the program reviews.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. Actually, I'll need this. Good morning, Chairman Arascata and Vice Chairman DeCarlo and members of the ARSA committee. I'm excited to enthusiastic to be here to provide a description of UNR's academic program review procedures and presents an outstanding example of this for the 2022-2023 program review process. So at UNR, all our program reviews are structured around our strategic plan and the goals of the university, and also around what is required by NWCC for accreditation. So, as you know, the last couple of years, we have just approved throughout it the new UNR strategic plan, 2023-2027 strategic plan, the Wolfpack Rising document. Again, a lot of the goals in there are used to assess the metrics that we evaluate our programs for. We have also just gone through the NWCC accreditation process, and we are received some preliminary results from that, recommendations from the accreditors, and we'll have a final decision on our accreditation in January at the NWCC commissioners meeting. We have periodic assessment of gen ed objectives too. That was one thing that we worked really hard on in our gen ed review, and so that is part of our accreditation review that we did. Annual learning we do the program reviews each year, and all departments are required to do annual learning outcomes assessment for the specific courses within their academic degrees. We also have specialized accreditations for our College of Business, College of Education, College of Engineering, and Schools of Social Work, et cetera. We have a number of professional organizations that review those programs, and we weave those accreditations into the program review process. Okay, so the program review schedule that we have, we review our programs every 7 years, and to ensure that we meet NSHE's requirement for the review of every 10 years. The review schedule is maintained by the provost office, and we distribute annually to the colleges, so they have plenty of time to know when their programs are coming up for review. The programs that are undergoing the accreditation process by a professional accreditor, we work with them to align their schedule with that accreditation visit requirements. Okay. Our general guidelines for our review process, our program reviews are typically department-centered, where all the academic programs are offered within a department are simultaneously evaluated in a given year. The process is open and collaborative, involving all faculty and administrators within those units. The department prepares a self-study for the progress since the last review, so we would like them to reflect on the previous review and talk about where they're going in the future. Our reviews include visit from external reviewers, experts from departments, similar departments throughout the country. We prefer to have reviewers that are at least at the department chair level, so they could really evaluate the operations and what's going on within each of these departments. And we carefully screen, the provost office screens reviewers to make sure there's no conflicts of interest in that process. Our review is based on, starts with a self-evaluation from the department, where we do effectively a SWOT analysis. We look at the strengths and weaknesses, opportunities and threats associated with the program. Again, we want to have a holistic and data-driven process. Again, we look at specific analytics, metrics that we're looking at, student enrollments, SFFTEs, recruitment, retention, time to degree, et cetera. And we also look at the course and curriculum to make sure that the modes of instruction and pedagogy are adequate and rigorous and comparable to our peer institutions. Okay. We also make sure that we're looking at student services, how we're applying advising and mentoring and other types of student supports, academic supports to our students within each department. And then we look at the capacity of the departments to offer degrees. We look at the faculty workload. We also look at their productivity in terms of, and in terms of research, teaching, and their engagement activities. Okay. And then we also review their research in terms of how productive they are in terms of external funding, grants, contracts, publications, and all those other such things. Okay. So today I'm really excited to talk to you about our Department of Biology. This was an outstanding review. We had it just went really well, and we like to highlight this department. The Department of Biology is one of our largest departments on campus. We have 1,081 undergraduates. This is data since the review, so it hasn't been updated for this coming year, and 153 graduate students. They offer a number of degrees, but the degrees we're going to talk about in this review are the BS and MS in biology. Students in biology also participate in interdisciplinary graduate programs, which we review separately away from this departmental review. But a lot of students in the biology department are enrolled in the MS and PhD programs in ecology, evolution, conservation biology, also the graduate programs in integrated neuroscience, and also in cellular and molecular biology, which I forgot to put in here. We have a fairly large faculty in this department. We have 27 tenured track faculty, and 10 teaching faculty. The student to faculty ratio is 35-1, which is a little higher than we were looking for, but this department does quite a bit of teaching in the service area. So any of the life sciences, the students are required to take a number of the foundational biology courses, which are addressed through the Department of Biology. In terms of what our student body look like in this department, undergraduate majors are fairly diverse. We have about 60% students of color enrolled in this program. The graduate program is a little less diverse, but we have about 25% of our students are students of color. Both the undergraduate and graduate programs have a large percentage of females, 60% or higher, in those majors. We also serve a diverse group of students in terms of socioeconomic status. We have about 28% of of the students are first gen, and depending on the year, the Pell eligible students are between 25 and 30% thereabouts. The biology undergraduate programs, we can go over some key indicators here. We have very, very strong fall to spring retention, 85%, and equally fairly strong freshman to sophomore year retention of 77%. They do an excellent job at engaging their students through a number of activities, including peer instructional opportunities for their students for acting as discussion leaders and such. I have a typo here on the graduation rates. I wish our four-year graduation was 67%. But it's flipped. So our four-year graduation rate is 48%, and our six-year graduation is 67%. Still very respectable numbers. In that, the last academic year, 2022-2023 academic year, we graduated 256 bachelor's degree students, and the average GPA was 3.3. Many of our students go on to professionals who are graduate programs, so we feel that this performance makes them highly competitive, not only for these further education, but also in the job market. The graduate program is also very successful. We have 37 students alone in the MS biology program. There is 104 total PhD MS students in the other integrated programs. The MS graduates typically use this as a launch point to launch their graduate careers, and they matriculate to the interdisciplinary programs to earn their PhDs. The average time to achieve their MS degree is 5.9 semesters. Okay. Most of the graduate students in this department are funded in terms of GTAs. A lot of them teach in the biology, foundational biology courses, or are assigned as have appointments as graduate research assistants. And U.S. News and World Reports has ranked our biology graduate program in the 175th, so the top 200. So this is a pretty impressive department. Okay, biology has a number of research areas in the area of cellular and molecular biology, ecology, evolutionary biology, and neuroscience. They are highly productive, one of the probably top five departments in terms of grant support. In fiscal year 2022, they received almost $7 million in grants. In terms of publications, they are averaging almost three publications a year per faculty. Okay. And in that year, they produced 525 publications. And we're really happy to see that we have three faculties are awarded NSF Career Awards in recent years. So at the outcome of the review, they had a number of very complimentary commendations. They commented on the strong leadership. We have Sander Alexander is our the chair. We have a structure where we have associate chairs that kind of focus a lot on the instructional side. So the department is well structured. They have very innovative teaching practices and high impact pedagogies. They are able to identify their top students and use them to be discussion leaders in courses, which has really done a great job at engaging students, but also allowing them to expand their engagement with the students that we couldn't do with just GTAs and such. Okay. Again, they are impressed by their research and this faculty or the morale of the faculty enthusiasm for the goals of the department. The recommendations they had, and this is kind of a recommendation that we need to address globally at UNR, is we need to strengthen our programmatic assessment of degree programs. We are working on helping them with that, but also throughout the university. They'd like to decrease the student to advisor ratio. Again, being one of the largest majors in the university, it's a little higher than what we would like. And they would like us to, they've suggested they would to strongly support the undergraduate peer teaching program, making sure that that is continued. There was also an issue related to the research facilities. The biology department is primarily located in the Fleischmann Agriculture Building, which is a fairly one of our oldest research buildings on campus, and they feel like the reviewers felt like the faculty would really benefit from having more modern facilities available to them in the future. Okay. In the upcoming years, we are working to launch a new academic program assessment planning and reporting system. This is underway. We have got a subscription to the Watermark platform to help with this process. Since this slideshow was put together, the college engineer has undergone their ABET accreditation, so we're waiting for the outcomes of that. And the College of Business is just starting their AACSB accreditation process. So with that, I think I could stop. Do you have any questions? Yes.
Any questions from the dais?
This is Regent Del Crow. I have a question.
Please.
Thank you. Thank you, David, for this interesting presentation. On those recommendations where it says decrease student to advisor ratio, what are the numbers right now? Because I know this board set a policy at one time, 350-1. I thought UNR was there.
Yeah, we are there. Well, okay, so we, as the college is able to support them at 350-1, I think what they were really talking were the faculty mentoring component.
Okay.
We have faculty that serve as advisors also, but they end up taking like 500-1, you know, because we have fewer faculty. And this is primarily acting as mentors, career mentors, you know, kind of looking at them in their last 2 years. So they still have the nuts and bolts advising available through the college, and that's probably adequate at 350-1. But in terms of kind of guiding them through their kind of career aspirations, we need to figure a way to get more faculty involved in that process. And they're working on developing a strategy to do that.
Did they give you a figure of what you need to work for?
No, they didn't.
Okay.
They just felt like it landed on a few faculty to do some of this kind of career mentoring, and they would like to expand that across the...
Okay. And I have another question, please.
Sure.
The other recommendation was modern facilities needed to support 21st century life science research and teaching. Is that within that statement, is that where that life science building would go someday in the gateway?
Yes, that would be really beneficial to not only their department, but some other life sciences departments on campus. It is just, you know, I had a laboratory in the Fleischmann Agriculture Building. It is a very nice building, but there are some... It's getting long in the tooth, and for some of the kinds of precision and high-tech kinds of equipment and instrumentation, it would be nice to have a more modern facility.
So. Oh, I agree. I toured that building. I think it was built in 1959, so it needs to be upgraded for sure. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I concur with Regent Del Carlo. That was very gracious to say is long in the tooth, Regent Del Carlo. That bill is in desperate need of upgrades. Also, in following up on another comment by Chair Del Carlo, you just mentioned that the advising is 350-1. Is that hindering the graduation numbers, as in slowing down the student's opportunity to graduate in a timely four-year degree?
No, they have a pretty good rate of, and I think their four-year graduation, six-year graduation rate is higher than the university average. So I think they're doing a great job. The college is doing a great job fostering students through the advising process and making sure that their courses are taken in the right order and such. I think the reviewers were commenting on more of that kind of professional mentoring aspect of that's needed. And that is really important for as students want to go seek careers in industry or go towards graduate school. But they have done a really great job at retaining and having the students progress towards degree completion.
Thank you. Any more questions from the dais? Hearing none, let's move on to the next presentation from Great Basin College.
So I now introduce GBC's Associate Vice President for Faculty Success and Dean of Health and Human Sciences. Dean of Health Science and Human Services, Amber Dinelli. Amber, we have here.
Good morning, Chair Escada, Vice Chair DiCarlo, and ARSA committee members. It is an awesome opportunity for me to talk about one of our health science programs today as part of our program review. As we start this, I would just tell you that we have a pretty rigorous program review process similar to what Mr. Shitani was talking about. We have a curriculum review committee. We assess all of our general education. If it's tied to a program, we review programs every 7 years on a seven-year cycle. We typically, and what I'm going to talk to you today about is going to be our radiology science program. We typically will align those programs that have outside accreditation with that seven-year cycle so that we can assure that the review that we do is thorough and adequate when we have outside accreditation or state requirements as well. So as part of that review, we also include our advisory boards. Part of that curriculum review committee includes faculty members, students. We put industry partners in if it's a program that requires that, such as the one we're going to talk about today. We also heavily rely on data and trends in data, and we look at that over a 3 and 5 year period so that we can see that programs are actually either maintaining the enrollment that they have or increasing the enrollment. When we see enrollment that is decreasing, obviously we're looking at what those factors are. Is there a need? Is there adequate resources for the program? And also because we have multiple locations, it may be something that's related to where we're providing that type of education. So the radiology program that we're talking about today started back in 2006. It started with low numbers of around 4 to 5 students and has progressively grown over the last several years, obviously several years, as we looked at this program. It is currently accredited by the Joint Review Committee on Education for Radiology. It also, that radiology accreditation process is approved by the Department of Education for the United States. It oversees 700 programs within the United States. And it started their mission and their process back in 1969. So it has a longstanding history of accrediting programs. Their vision is to assure all medical imaging and radiological programs achieve excellence in education and programmatic accreditation. They do this by awarding an 8-year, a 5-year, a 3-year, and a 2-year interval accreditation, and that's based on performance. Currently, Great Basin College is on an 8-year accreditation cycle, and that was just recently reviewed and obtained in October 2023 at the JCERT board meeting. Great Basin College radiology program is a transferable associate degree. We changed that from an associate of applied science about 2 years ago. We made this so it was going to be transferable. It was something that our students really talked to us about. If they wanted to go on and get a bachelor's degree, that associate of applied science was really limiting. And because our students take so many prerequisites in science, this was actually a better fit and a good choice to make. And as we did this review, we noted that our students actually appreciated that transferability, and that was the right choice to make. Our mission is to provide high-quality, accessible, and affordable undergraduate radiology education that will graduate competent, entry-level radiographers to serve the local, national, and healthcare communities. We want to expand our workforce throughout the state. The program offers radiology in both Elko and Pahrump campuses. We have clinical sites located throughout the entire state of Nevada. This includes Elko to Winnemucca in the north, Carson and Reno in the west, Ely in the east, and Pahrump and Las Vegas in the south, with numerous clinical sites in between. Through generous grant funding, state-of-the-art digital imaging equipment, phantoms, and lab equipment has been purchased and utilized in this program for these students. Because we have two different programs, one in Pahrump and one in Elko, the picture that you're seeing here is an updated radiology lab that we have in Elko. It has all the state-of-the-art equipment, and this was funded through the William M. Pennington Foundation. We've had this for about 4 years. It's fantastic. Some of the technology within our community, they actually had to update some of our local hospitals and clinics because we had the state-of-the-art equipment, and we're putting people out there using that. So in Pahrump, what we have is basically a mock lab with mock equipment, so they can simulate the x-rays, but not to this extent. And so as we get further on, that will be one of our recommendations. The GBC radiology program has noted growth and sustainability despite the nationwide decrease in interest in some healthcare programs due to COVID. The largest class since the program's inception was in 2022, and the stable enrollment of this program has continued through 2020 and 2023. The enrollment trends noted on this slide may appear to be decreasing. This was based on an unusually high enrollment cohort of 2020 and graduating in 2022. Typically, our enrollments in this program are 9 to 12 students. Cohorts entering the program in 2021, 2022, and 2023 show a consistent enrollment of students. When we looked at the American Association of Radiology Technology credentialing, that's the AART exam that our radiology students take, and we looked at that from 2020 to 2023, you will find that the average credentialing success has increased from an average of 88% to 100% in years 2022 and 2023 in our graduates. Curricular changes, testing preparation practices, quality of our student recruitment are amongst other activities are what we credit this positive change for. When we get 100% 2 years in a row on credentialing testing for our students, we like to celebrate that, and that's a big win when we start seeing the changes that we've made are paying off for our students. It means that they can be employed readily after they take the credentialing exam, and they don't have to wait for retesting times. The GBC Radiology Program is proud to be educating and preparing a diverse workforce. We have Hispanic, Caucasian, Native American, and Polynesian cultures have been represented in our recent cohorts. The male-to-female ratio demonstrates males are underserved and underrepresented in this program, which has led us to look at what our recruitment practices are, and how we can better recruit males into our program. Some of our program strengths are that our retention rate of our students making it through the program is 91%. That pass rate, due to that 100% the last 2 years, gives us an average of 3 years at 96%. And our job placement rate is at 96%. When we survey our students, it's really hard. Anytime you survey any students, getting those surveys back, what we got was 82%. However, in between that time, we're right about the six-month mark for our students, and we were able to achieve a 100% satisfaction rate on 12 out of 14 students replied to the survey. So that's a big deal when you get that many students to actually reply to a survey and give us 100%. So all positive things. The eight-year site visit for the JCERT accreditation was completed on the GBC campus in May of 2023. The visit was exceptionally positive, with no citations administered. The program was commended by the site visitors for organization, presentation of all the documentation, and our excellent use of our learning platform, Web Canvas. The program was found to be compliant in all six of the six JCERT accreditation standards, which I'm told is pretty rare. In compliance with the college and department accreditation standards, the radiology program hosts an advisory board meeting with local stakeholders, including faculty, students, administrators, employers, clinical staff, and community members once per semester. The most recent advisory board meetings held in October suggested from the advisory board that one of the things that they asked us what our challenges were. Sometimes it's the scholarship opportunities for our students in radiology. We have a tendency to have a lot of scholarship money for students in our nursing program, and so some of our other allied health programs don't get that same attention. And that was brought to us by our advisory board, saying that they were willing to work on a project with our industry healthcare partners to come up with scholarships specifically for radiology students, and that's currently in the works. Another positive point out of these advisory board meetings was the feedback that we got from employers saying that our recent graduates were performing at a very high level. We like to take the feedback that we get. We also take the feedback that we got from JCERT, and one of the things that they talked to us about were opportunities for improvement. At each of the clinical sites, because we have multiple sites, as I discussed with you, they asked us to put a certificate showing that they are a JCERT-affiliated location and that we have students there, that they are fully approved. And so that's one of the things that we are in the process of doing. We'll have that in place by January. The other thing were some of the updates in our handbook, which were specific to some of the equipment that we use and some of the handling of the reports and some of the equipment pieces of transferring those slides of x-rays. And so we made sure that we went back into our handbook and wrote those more accurately. We also offered in this last advisory board meeting an opportunity for, as part of that project planning, for different people and different stakeholders to participate in our fundraising events for our scholarship opportunities. And we had numerous people join that committee, and so I'm looking forward to seeing what we can pull together. Lots of times our scholarships come from industry. So our plan is to make sure that even though we're pleased with the performance of our review, we're happy that we got a lot of accolades from JCERT. We were able to align all the curriculum. Everything was tight with the strategic plan. We know that we need to make sure that we are recruiting that underrepresented population of male students into our program. And so that's one of the areas that we're going to continue to work on. And increasing those recruitment opportunities and working with our advisors. The other thing would be looking for a funding opportunity for the Pahrump area and having that modernized equipment at that location as well. So I thank you for the opportunity to discuss this program, and I'm open to any questions that you might have. Thank you so much.
Wonderful presentation. Thank you. Let's open the questions and comments to the dais, please.
This is Regent Del Carlo. I have some questions. Thank you. On slide five, you talked about, this was a really great presentation too, 101.5 credits.
Oh, sorry. Thank you for catching that.
I thought you needed 60 credits to get an associate.
Yeah, so that is an error. It is 86.5, and thank you for pointing that out. I'm not sure how that got in there, but it is 86.5. Typically, health science programs do have a higher number of credits. This program has around 1,500 of clinical hours, and so that's why you see those credits higher than over the 60. And in comparison with most nursing programs, it's about 70 to 72 in a nursing program. Nursing programs only have around 500 clinical hours. So when you're looking at a difference of 1,500, that's where you get that credit.
Okay, that makes sense.
Thank you so much for correcting that. Yeah,
no, the clinical hour part makes sense, but 101 was like, what? I didn't get this. Okay. And on slide six, do your graduates stay in your communities? I mean, do they stay there? Because I know at Banner Hospital, I remember a presentation WNC did one time, and every nurse they graduate stays right there.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Regent DiCarlo. For the record, Amber Dinelli. Our graduates typically stay where they live. However, in the radiology program, they do have to rotate through three different locations, which is why we have partnerships throughout the state of Nevada, because they have to go to different hospitals within those rotations. And so ultimately, it does give them an opportunity to maybe see what it's like in Fallon, if they're from Elko, but they typically stay, I would say it's probably 80% stay within the communities they live. Probably closer to 100% stay in the state of Nevada. So sometimes we might have somebody who moves out of state, but most likely they're just going to move to a different community within the state of Nevada.
So on a follow-up to that, if they have three different places they do their rotations, where is that? If you're, like I live in Elko, taking this program, where am I required to go?
So ultimately, you might start in Elko, then you might end up in Fallon, and then you might end up in Pahrump. And so our students are told that ahead of time. They also might end up in Carson Tahoe. They could end up at Desert View Hospital in Pahrump. So our students usually, I mean, they know that going in, and they provide for housing and have a plan for that when they start.
And how long does that last? I mean, I didn't know we did that, so that's why I have so many questions.
Yeah, no, radiology and medical imaging, the sonography program, are two unique programs, the fact that they do have to have multiple locations where they're training. And so typically they'll do that over two semesters.
And what's the length of time that they're, like, in a different site than their home?
Usually 8 to 12 weeks.
Wow. That's really a commitment. Mm-hmm. Gosh, wow. Okay, and one more question. On page, slide 13, let's see. You talked about you had to change your handbook for the prohibition of students holding image receptors. I don't know what you're talking about. What's an image receptor, and is it something they can walk out with?
Well, it would be kind of heavy to walk out with. But some, like I said, some of the technology that we have at some of the older hospitals are still have the handheld x-ray. It's like a plate.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
So that plate is what you, I mean, I believe that plate is around $45,000. So you can understand why we have to have policy for how to appropriately handle it. And okay. So it's just the transferring of that plate.
Okay, and the modern way today is you don't have the plate. Is that right?
Sometimes the plate is built in to that imagery, and so they're not moving that around like that, or it swings or moves. It's okay, a different type of component.
Thank you. Thank you again. Great program.
Thank you.
Very astute questions. Very well done. Thank you, Vice Chair Del Carlo. Are there any other questions on the dais?
Regent Cruz Crawford.
Please.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Regent Cruz Crawford, for the record. Thank you, Dr. I want to say your name right. I always say, call you Amber. So Dr. That's okay.
Danelli.
Danelli. Okay. Dr. Danelli. I just wanted to share a comment. I know I've been quiet this morning. I got an opportunity to tour your facility, and I know that you have built a lot of our health science programs from the ground up. So I just want to thank you for the work you've done in the community. As I toured Great Basin's health sciences program in Ely and Elko, I was shocked when I first heard the numbers of students that graduate, just being a UNLV girl myself. And it says in 2021, you graduated 8, 2022, 14, and 2023, 8 from this radiological sciences program. And when I went around and I was able to talk to the community, I really understood the impact that that has on the community. And it's so difficult in rural communities to, you know, sometimes we're medical deserts. And I just want to say, you know, these numbers might look small, but they have a huge impact on our community. And I just appreciate the work that GBC does in our community to make sure that we are safe and healthy and have very high quality skilled technicians. And that's a lot thanks to you. So I wanted to thank you for that.
Thank you.
Regent McMichael.
Are there any questions or comments? Oh, please go ahead, Regent McMichael.
Yes, so Regent Donald McMichael, for the record. I'm extremely pleased to see that the graduates, most of them, stay within the state. That's greatly appreciated, and mostly seeing that the students want to maintain their presence here in the state, and that's just wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any more questions online or on the dais? Thank you very much. Wonderful presentations to both institutes. Very well done. Thank you. We're going to move on to agenda item number 11, which is the Nevada System of Higher Education Data Dashboard. This is going to be looked at as a lens of a very high altitude lens. Just a brief introduction for not everybody, not just only for everybody on the dais, but also for the crowd, the audience, for the individuals watching us online, to get a really good grasp of the work involved in the statistics in which we, the System of Higher Education, have for the public to be get as transparent as possible. In March, there'll be a much wider net that'll be cast as we'll have more updated numbers. So please, I think I see Ms. Davis, and I'm not quite sure the gentleman next to you is Jose. Please continue.
Thank you. For the record, Renee Davis, Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. And I have with me Jose Martinez, NG's IR director and creator of the majority, if not all, of these dashboards. So we're delighted to be here today to do this introduction. We know it's Regent Arascada's most favorite topic, so we're delighted to be here. And let me just start quickly with a description of where we get our data from. So the primary place is really from our NG Student Data Warehouse, and that actually comes from the institution. So there's a process that happens multiple times through the year where data is reported to the system office, to Jose's operation. And we also use data from NPower, which is Nevada's statewide longitudinal data system. We actually have a member on staff who is supports that process, Sarah Echo. And we also, of course, we report to, but we also use data from IPEDS. So those are the three main sources you'll see here. And so with that, we're just going to go ahead and jump right in. And so I encourage all of you in the audience to please follow along, use that link So you can see all the numbers and the richness of the dashboards up close. So as Regent Arascata said, we're just going to do a fast intro so you can start digging in on your own. This is the landing page here. If you go to ir.nevada.edu, you can also, by the way, access it from our main webpage. If you go to, there's a menu on the departments, and then there's the data center. So we'll go ahead and start with the first in the drop-down there, data and dashboards. We're going to start with awards conferred. And so, again, we're not really going to talk about the data itself, just about the functionality of the dashboard. And so one of the really important things for all of these dashboards is they all have a menu, drop-down menu, usually in the upper left, that allows you to select. Usually you can select all of Venti, you can select certain institutions, and so you can really get a specific view if that's what you're looking for, or you can see the whole system together. Another feature of the dashboards is the tooltips. And so anytime you wave your cursor over any of the columns, you can see there's some additional information that's provided. And again, it's really much more effective if you have your screen in front of you. I know it's a little hard to see up on the big screen. And then finally, you can actually click on, Jose is clicking on all these different things, and you can select which items you want to focus in on. And then if you click on a column, does this one go? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then you can see more detail from within that column. And so we'll go ahead and go on and slide through some of these other areas. So next one is college readiness. And we actually had the opportunity to present recently to the Board of Education on this particular dashboard, and we did take a deep dive into the actual data. Some of these more complex dashboards have a front page that is about the dashboard, which delves into the specific data sources, lots of definitions, because sometimes it's not going to be exactly clear what is included in those columns or numbers you see. And so that is kind of a quick overview there. And you can see here's one of the charts that comes along with this dashboard having to do with high school continuation. So lots of rich data here for those of you who are interested in the pipeline into our institutions. So let's go ahead and go to the next. So the next one is going to look a little different. This one is the completion and workforce, and it's actually a report that is in compliance with the NRS. The citation is right there, and here's the section of the statute. And each of these areas expands to either display data or information. And so this one is pretty complex, so you might want to take some time. And then again, this one actually has the multiple drop-down menus, so you can really zero in as you wish to look at a certain degree, certain institution, that type of thing. So going next, we have our dual enrollment dashboard, and I'm really, this is one of our dashboards, again, relating to K-12, and it's going to talk about the enrollments, high school students in taking either dual or concurrent enrollment classes. And again, this is a very complex set of data, so there's a lot of explanation up front about the data that exists in this dashboard. And you can see a lot of these have a variety of tables and charts. So lots of times the data is presented in a couple different ways so you can get a handle on it. This one, like the College Readiness, has multiple tabs with different data sets. And we presented a couple summers ago to the Legislative Committee on Education about this dashboard. So it's been with us for a little while. Another of the dashboards, and this one is falls in the set of IPEDS dashboards, so it's compiled with data that comes from IPEDS. And of course, the way IPEDS gets it is our institutions all report into IPEDS, and that's a requirement for federal student aid programs that we participate in that data process. So this is just really more of the same. You have the tooltips. You can delve in different detail. And you have a variety of information all on this one page. and fall enrollment, you'll see here. And this might be a good time to talk about the timing of the data coming into the dashboards. So Jose and Sarah go through and update the dashboards as soon as new data is available. And you notice, of course, the most recent we have is fall of 22. That's because fall of 23 is still underway. But you can also see that there's going to be a notation towards the bottom that talks about when the dashboard was last updated. And sometimes when we do those updates, we're using preliminary data, which is just to say that there's a chance that some of the data might change. It's usually not very substantial, but there could be some changes. So we always make sure we're careful with that label as well. The next one is graduation rates. And so, you know, it's more of the same in terms of the setup. And what's neat about this one is we have two that deal with graduation rates. So we have the straight graduation rate. And as a reminder, this is first-time, full-time students based on a cohort. So students who come in a given fall semester as a first-time and a full-time student, they're the ones who get put in this cohort, and that's one of the conventions that is used by IPEDS. And so that's why we always look at these numbers, but we also created this graduation rate plus transfer out rate, recognizing that the community colleges also, in addition to graduates and associates and certificates, they also are a main feeder into our four-year institutions. And so if you look at the graduation rate plus transfer out, you'll see, of course, that it's higher. And those students have continued on as intended if they have a transfer associate degree that they've earned or declared. So strategic plan metrics is our next one, and you'll see that within each of these categories, there are multiple dashboards that help all of you to track the progress in all of these goals. And so Jose just clicked on fall-to-fall persistence rates, and you can change the institution up top just like you can on the other dashboards. And this one doesn't have a button to reprocess it. It does it automatically, but you notice on some of the, I think, the older dashboards, you might have to click on a button to update. But this one does it dynamically. Okay, so co-requisite completions. This is our most recent dashboard, and we're particularly proud of it and also proud of the work. I'll just use this as a plug for March. We plan to come to the board with a full update on the co-requisite implementation. So be ready for a really data-rich discussion at that meeting. And then finally, this is also a new dashboard, student transfer. And earlier, VP Alexander talked about the Meet STEM conference that was hosted at UNR. That was all ANCHI institutions participating and really trying to work together as a system on transfer of STEM students from our two-year to our four-year institutions. And so this dashboard was actually a request of the faculty and advisors who attended that conference, and we worked together on some system-level goals. And so this is one of the goals, which is to start looking at once a student actually declares a transferable associate degree, what happens to them? Do they transfer? Do they make it? Do they earn their degree? Do they go to another institution? So there's lots of data in this dashboard. And that'll actually bring me to one last thing, is the transfer dashboard, the co-requisite completions, all of those things are works in progress. So not only do we go in and update the data as we're able to, but we're always working on additions and enhancements in terms of what data we're examining to tell the full story. So, for example, what you see on this one and on the co-requisite outcomes, we're looking at what other data can we feature to dig deeper into those items. So with that, I'll conclude our presentation, and we stand ready to answer questions.
Thank you. I'm going to go to the dais in just 1 minute. Mr. Martinez, if you could you show the audience and those participating today the simplicity of going to the NSHE main page, our homepage, and accessing the data dashboard that way, please?
Sure.
Kind of walk us through it, sir.
Oh, excuse me. Jose Martinez for the record. So from the NSHE website, you will see the drop-down menu for system administration. And from that menu, you can see data center. Clicking on that link, you should see a series of links that you can access or click that will take you to our IR website.
And then once again, up on the top right-hand side where it says data dashboard, that's the drop-down?
Correct.
Thank you. I encourage everyone to take a look at this. This is a true testament of the work being done throughout the system. Let me forward this over to the dais, please. Anyone?
Mr. Chair, this is Regent Perkins, if I may.
Yes, Regent Perkins.
Thank you. I know I'm not on this committee, but I appreciate the opportunity. I was looking at the institutional employee headcount. Did I miss it where the data is disaggregated by self-disclosed or self-identifying, like, race numbers? Did I miss it? Because it breaks down, like, the archivist and librarians and management and instructional, but then it doesn't get more detailed than that. Below it, it says the employee headcount by ethnicity, but that's all the employees as opposed to a specific type of employee. So did I miss that on the IR, on the data dashboard?
So Regent Perkins, this is Renee Davis for the record. If you look, so it's actually a kind of side-by-side charts. And so as you first look at that, and if you are on a smaller screen, it might be vertically rendered, but there is an employee headcount by ethnicity and race.
But it doesn't list the specific type of employee, like whether it's a classified employee or whether it's a faculty or whether it's part-time.
Understood, and I apologize for that. No, we don't have that data here, do we, Jose?
Jose Martinez, for the record. That data is not broken down in that at that level, but we do have the data elements to filter further down. For this dashboard is not currently available, but that is something that we can add to it.
Thank you. Well, I'll just I'm asked to put that on new business then. Thank you so much. Thanks, Chair.
Pleasure. Let's go to the committee members, please.
Sorry, excuse me, Regent Arascada. One thing to keep in mind is that for IPEDS, IPEDS doesn't collect status on classified or professional. It's just the different categories that you can see here. That is it. Deepest level that it's reported by employee, but we can add that part-time and full-time and same thing with the ethnicity by those occupation programs.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for the clarification, Mr. Martinez. Anyone on the dais from the committee, please?
I have a comment, Chair Escada. Regent Del Carlo.
Please, Vice Chair.
I have not been on this for a while, and I knew the website had been overhauled, and wow, this is really good. I'm looking forward to March when we have the deep dive, because I was really concerned. We have not been having ARSA and BFF at the same time, and I think the whole board needs this information, so I'm really glad to hear there is a deep dive at the March meeting, and this information is just like at our fingertips. And I like the fact that it's so transparent. Anybody can look at it. And, you know, we've got a really huge task ahead of us with this funding formula committee that's going to have effect on us for the next probably 10 years, because it's been 10 years since that last committee. So when I'm sure our chancellor can update us on that at some point, but Because whoever we hire in that role that's going to come in, that outside consultant, I mean, what a wealth of knowledge they're going to have there. Because this all factors into what it is we need to ask the legislature for. And we're going to get into this discussion later, but we got to do a really good job of asking next time. So thank you for this information. And who's responsible? Who keeps us up to date? Is that you, Jose?
Yes. Jose Martinez for the record. Yes, and also my programmer analyst, Sarah Aiko.
And I have to say, it's really pleasing to see a lot of different colors. I'm a graphic kind of person when I look and learn. And when things are just in black and white, it's hard to see. But when things are in color, it's so much easier to, I don't know if it's psychological or if there's data, but it really is. You guys have done a beautiful job on this website. Thank you.
Regent Cruz.
Thank you. Crawford. Yeah, please. Go ahead, Ms. Crawford.
Thank you, Chair Arriscada. Jose, thank you. And I know Chair Arriscada, chair of this committee, is obsessed with the data dashboard. Him and I have spent some time to get it there reviewing. One thing that caught our eye, I don't know if you remember this conversation, Chair Arriscada, but we were concerned about the employee headcount and how it's reported from fall of 2021. And I think that is very important data. So can you explain, Jose, why that's has not been updated since we're entering 2024?
Yes, Jose Martinez for the record. Yes, because we work with the cycle that IPEDS uses for reporting data. We have to wait until that data is available. Once the institutions report that data, it takes about 7 to 8 months before that data becomes public, in which point, as soon as that data is available, we will update this dashboard. We're in the process of getting the 2022 data. 2023 is not reported until April of 2024. So there is a lag in the year, in the time that is reported. So we're usually running about a year to 2 years apart, depending on when the data becomes public.
It just seems like some of the easiest data to grab. Have we had discussions of ways that we can fast track that or other ways to retrieve that information?
Jose Martinez, for the record, I wish there was something I could do. Unfortunately, because it is from IPEDS and that is a national survey, it will take a lot more than me requesting to change that cycle.
Something to think about, I guess. Thank you.
Thanks.
Regent Arriscada, I have a follow-on question to Regent Crawford, Cruz Crawford.
Please, Vice Chair.
Okay, I agree with Regent Cruz Crawford. I mean, it's data is only as good as in the moment. I mean, it takes so long. We've always said this. So I don't even know. Is IPEDS a separate entity? Is it part of the Department of Education or what? Because I'm only saying this because being a member of ACCT, we have two missions. We educate and we advocate. And if I were to come, we're doing our legislative summit next February, and we always meet with the Department of Education. I mean, is this something under their wheelhouse? And if we have difficulty getting, not difficulty is not the right word, but a little frustration since the data comes to us so delayed, I'm sure there's ever institutions, but who knows? I mean, I know the federal government takes a lot to get moving, so.
Jose Martinez, for the record, it's the feds, they determine the schedule. Now, because we report data as of a given point in time, that doesn't mean that the institutions don't have that information available. They can still report it independently. But because we want to keep our data consistent by following the IPEDS guidelines, we like to keep that cycle with IPEDS.
And you say that because IPEDS is the standard that all public institutions use?
Jose Martinez, for the record. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Regent Cruz Crawford for follow-up through Chair Arriscada.
Please, follow-up.
Can we utilize another data source and have a disclaimer that it's preliminary non-iPad data, such as Workday or...
Jose Martinez, for the record, yes, there is something that we can do. We can just collect that directly from the institutions and have a disclaimer that, you know, while we can follow iPad's definitions, mm-hmm. we can just collect that data at any other point in time.
I can't imagine it would be a heavy lift because that's something that should already be reported within, you know, our HR. So I would love that information, especially since we always have discussions of, you know, we're going to have our COLA discussion, how that impacts our staffing, how that impacts our students, overload of students and classes. This is very, very important data that we need up to date, and it's going to be changing rapidly. So I would really appreciate that. Thank you. I'll put that on new business, Mr. Arscada. Or sorry, Chair Arscada.
Close enough. My only concern with that request, though, Regent Cruz Crossford, is the discrepancy in numbers. Not that I'm ever making the accusation that any institute would fudge on the numbers, but once the numbers come through iPads and there is a discrepancy between the numbers, having to go back and retract some of the previous numbers and graphs and statistics that have already been stated, yes, there might be a note at the bottom and or a narrative stating that they're preliminary numbers, but I'm not quite sure how that'll look upon each institute if the official numbers from iPads come back with a significant discrepancy.
Thank you. We can debate that in new business when it comes on the agenda.
Wonderful. Any more questions, comments in regards to this topic? Excellent. Ms. Davis and Mr. Martinez, well done. And we are, as Vice Chair, we are definitely looking at RPT 5.
Chair Scott, I believe a president wanted to say something.
Please.
Thank you, President Karen Hilgerson, for the record at TMCC. I agree, this dashboard is such a wonderful tool. However, I do have an important caveat. At my last performance metrics presentation, probably my last three performance metrics presentation, I have done my best to try to alert the board to the issue with iPads. iPads typically captures only first-time, full-time students for the predominantly two-year colleges here today. That is not our student demographic. I recall that for TMCC, most of these numbers represent about 9% of our students, so you're not getting the data of 92% of our students. This is a national issue. It's a national problem. At the ACCT, I had the pleasure to attend a session from one of my colleagues, the president of Salt Lake City Community College, and they have completely created their own new data sets based on pooling a variety of data, working with the local university that is a feeder so that they could get really accurate data. They are no longer emphasizing first-time, full-time iPads. I would respectfully ask that the website include clear notations that show that some of the data that iPads requires just doesn't represent our student population. Because legislators look at that, and I think they are misinformed because of those missing headlines. So I continue to be concerned. I also think it's helpful to provide the numbers of students, 50% of what? You know, I think that would be also very helpful. But again, I very, very am very concerned about iPads, and I think this board does have the power to suggest a new way to collect data in addition to iPads. Yes, the feds require iPads. Accreditors like to see iPads, but accreditors are also looking more so for data that really tells our story in the way that is truly representative and honest. And right now, first time, full time, it's not happening for us. Thank you.
Thank you, President Hilgerson. So very well stated. And I do see you, President Helens. But while you were doing that presentation or that conversation, that comment, President Hilgerson, I was watching the head of the three college presidents Bob as saying, yes, they are in full agreement with you. President Hellens, please, do you have a comment?
Thank you so much. I do want to really appreciate publicly that Regent Del Carlo and Cruz Crawford gets it and understands it's really an important question of why are we so focused on iPads in ENSHE, because really the system needs that complete picture. And both Karen Helgerson, President Helgerson, and I, during our metrics presentation, have said this over and over, because we're different. And so a complete picture benefits us all. Thank you.
Thank you, President Hellens. President Zaragoza, I'm going to give you the opportunity to chime in also, please.
I couldn't agree more kind of with the need for community colleges kind of to be looked at with, from a more appropriate lens. I would suggest that a lot of the data that you're looking is data that's 4 or 5 years old, but it's for those that aren't kind of familiar with iPads, they believe it's current data. So it not only is not accurate, it sometimes misinforms the public.
Thank you for the clarification. And as I mentioned, the strong advocacy by the three college presidents. Thank you. We're going to move on to Ms. Davis, Ms. Martinez. Well done. We're going to move on to item number 12. And we're going to first take the new business suggestions from the committee members. Are there committee members on the ARSA committee that have new business?
Regent Cruz Crawford?
Please.
I would like to review our data sources for our data dashboard, including iPads, to include looking for data sources that are more up to date and diversifying the need between community colleges and four-year institutions so that we can better advocate for ourselves funding-wise and for a program diversification. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Cruz Crawford. Anyone else?
Mr. Chair, Laura Perkins there. Just this, the disaggregation of the data by employee, by self-identified ethnicity groups. I would like to see that added to the dashboard.
Thank you, Regent Perkins. Appreciate it. Are there any more comments from anyone on the dais or new business from anyone on the dais? Hearing none, we're going to move on to public comment. Once again, as I stated previously, for those who would like to call in and offer public comment, please dial 669-444-9171. And please enter meeting ID 928-4944-5069. With the password, 555-555. I'm going to start with public comment from the meeting sites. Is there any public comment at GBC?
There is no public comment at GBC at this time.
Is there any public comment at the systems office here in Reno? Seeing none, we'll move on to public comment at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
There is no public comment in Las Vegas.
Thank you, Vice Chair. And move on to, is there any public comment on the phones?
There's no callers at this time.
Fantastic. It is 10:08. Thank you all for participating in Academic Research and Student Affairs. Until March, thank you much.